Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the partial withdrawal of Russian troops at the Ukrainian border and the visit by Russia's Prime Minister to Crimea that the new government in Kiev is condemning. We will speak with Andrew Cutchins, a senior fellow and director of the Center for Strategic and International Relations, Russia and Eurasia program, and discuss his criticism of President Obama's handling of the crisis with Putin over Russia's annexation of Crimea. And Andrew Cutchins' article at CNN, Does Obama Really Understand Putin? We will also explore possible ways to avoid a new tit-for-tat Cold War dynamic that seems all but inevitable as the recent talks between Secretary of State Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov appear to have gone nowhere, and relations between Putin and the United States continue to deteriorate. Then, with the release of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's latest report that global warming poses a growing threat to security, food supply, and human life, with a warning that the worst is yet to come, Elizabeth Colbert, a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and author of the new book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, joins us. We'll discuss whether the message that comes out of this report that the world has to adapt and mitigate means that it is too late to stop global warming, and what can be done to overcome the organized denial of the problem that is thwarting efforts to address an impending catastrophe. And joining us now is Andrew Cutchins, a senior fellow and director of the Center for Strategic and International Relations, Russia and Eurasian Program, as well as the former director of the Russian and Eurasian Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. His recent publications include Perspective, What's to Follow the Demise of the U.S.-Russian Reset, The End of the Reset, Russia's Foreign Policy, Continuity in Change. And he has an article at CNN, Does Obama Really Understand Putin? Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Cutchins.
My pleasure, Ian.
And what's your sense of the Putin's order of a partial withdrawal of the forces massed on the Ukrainian border? He mentioned that in a phone conversation with German Chancellor Angela Merkel, but he also talked about steps needed to stabilize the situation in Ukraine and Transnistria. Well, isn't that a bit ironic? I mean, isn't Putin the one that's destabilizing Ukraine and Transnistria?
Well, you and I would think so. I think, Ian. But you know, Mr. Putin may have a different sort of conceptual framework and map that he's working on. What can I say about the removal of some of the troops from the Ukrainian border? Well, that means it's probably less likely that a military invasion of Russian military invasion of Ukraine will take place tomorrow. But you know, we don't know what Mr. Putin is actually planning on doing. Mr. Putin may, at this time, may not know himself exactly what he is going to do in Ukraine. But one thing I'm virtually certain of, Ian, and that is that for Mr. Putin to win Crimea and to essentially lose the rest of Ukraine, that is not a satisfactory outcome for him at all. So I would expect him to continue to apply various measures to essentially deprive Ukraine of its sovereignty and its independence.
So just in terms of the withdrawal, apparently it's only about 500 men. It's the 15th Separate Motor Rifle Brigade Battalion. So there's still 40,000 soldiers there in place. There was talk that maybe having taken Ukraine, where, by the way, Prime Minister Medvedev is there and the Ukrainian government have denounced his visit. Does Russia need a land corridor to this newly seized territory? I mean, otherwise, there's no bridge across at Kerch, is there?
Or well, Kerch. Does a boa constrictor need to eat? Well, I don't mean to be facetious, but no, certainly Russia does not need a land corridor to Transnistria.
Or to Crimea, I was saying. You know, what about
Well, no, not necessarily. But you know, I think what we're facing here, Ian, is that Mr. Putin is accelerating the project for, you know, building a greater Russia. It's not something that's, you know, a remake of the Soviet Union, but it's a Russia certainly that's greater than its territorial extent right now. And, you know, he has been willing to use military instruments. He's been using economic instruments. He's been using cyber warfare instruments. He's been using intelligence instruments. He's been busing people across the Ukrainian border to stir things up. There are all kinds of tools that he's using. And certainly what he doesn't want to see is the existence of a government in Kyiv that can be viewed as more legitimate. So I think that, you know, elections are scheduled for May 25th in Ukraine. So I think between, you know, now and then, we're going to continue to see various kinds of pressure applied by Moscow, either to prevent those elections from happening, or to reconfigure the territorial facts on the ground, or to make sure that whoever might be elected in such an election is very, very, very sympathetic towards the interests of Moscow, and certainly far more trustworthy than Mr. Yanukovych.
Well, but isn't Yanukovych the kind of model that Putin is offering? Isn't it at the heart of what's going on in the Ukraine, a choice over a European model of governance and economics that has transparency and rule of law? And what Putin is offering, particularly now in Ukraine, is, you know, you're going to have a higher standard of living, but you're going to have, I mean, he's got this gangster, the Goblin, running the place, and Konstantinov, the speaker, is a scam artist who took a lot of money to build apartment buildings that weren't built. And that's the model. I mean, Yanukovych was a kleptocrat. By comparison to Putin, he's a small fry. But to my mind, that's really at the heart of it, is these two models. And I'm surprised that so many people in Russia accept this incredibly corrupt kleptocracy.
Well, that's a tough question. You know, Putin's popularity for the first, certainly the first 8 years when he was president, was basically due to economic prosperity growing in Russia, not necessarily due to policies that Mr. Putin implemented, but the most significant factor being both the increase in oil production and the dramatic increase in oil price. The global economic crisis, global financial crisis hit, Russia is exposed as vulnerable, but the global economy rebounded fairly quickly, the oil price rebounded fairly quickly. And so even when Mr. Putin took power, Russian economic growth was around 3 or 4%, despite the extraordinary sort of endemic corruption that existed in the country. Now, though, what's happened in the last 2 years, or almost 2 years since he's been in power, you know, Russian economic growth has stagnated to practically zero, despite the fact that oil prices are at a relatively historic high. Now, so Mr. Putin, I think, has decided to basically kind of, you know, change his game plan as to what provides him the domestic political support. It had been economic prosperity for the majority of Russians whose salaries had dramatically increased and pensions paid and all of that. Now, however, he's changing the conversation. And the emphasis is on sort of traditional conservative Russian values combined with, you know, Russia's sort of a special role for Russia in the world. To me, it kind of reminds me of going back to the 19th century Tsar Nicholas I, who was a very, very conservative, and his ideology was revolved around nationality, Russian nationality, autocracy, and orthodoxy. And Putin is playing that, and then a part of that, of course, is the efforts to rebuild something that is bigger than Russia itself. And, you know, so far he's getting payoff from it. You know, with a 10-12 point increase in popularity with the takeover of Crimea. But, you know, how long that's going to last is anybody's guess. I think, you know, at some point, I think essentially he is hastening his own demise. My worry, though, Ian, is that he's not going to go out with a whimper like Mr. Gorbachev in the Soviet Union. that we may be looking at sort of the second conclusion of the Cold War, which will be a more definitive conclusion, but I fear that it's going to be a much more bloody and conflict-ridden conclusion.
So given that bleak prognosis, what's then in your article at CNN, you're quite critical of the Obama administration, saying the only thing that surprised Putin was how weak Obama's response has been, and the administration was clearly not prepared for the contingency that Putin would act so brazenly. I spoke yesterday with Strobe Talbot, who pointed out that he disagreed with Henry Kissinger, who's apparently emphatically saying that the U.S. should assure Russia that NATO expansion into Ukraine is off the table. Strobe Talbot felt that should not be guaranteed, that at some time later Ukraine should have the option. And my sense is that Putin wouldn't be as popular as he is unless there was some collective sense of humiliation that the Russian people shared, that he was able to tap into. So why taunt the wounded bear?
Well, I think I completely agree with the argument that I pointed out in the CNN article that came out a few days ago, that I get asked the question all the time, why don't we get Putin? Why do American presidents have a hard time understanding him? And I think it kind of gets back to, it's very difficult, not only for American presidents or otherwise, but people in general, to understand the psychological trauma that several generations of Russians endured with the collapse of the Soviet Union, where from one day you go from being a superpower to the next day you're a recipient of humanitarian aid. You know, that it hasn't happened to me, for example. I just can't fathom how impactful that would be to my psychology. I think it would be huge, and I think there would be some pathologies that would be associated with it. And clearly, Mr. Putin carries these grievances, on his shoulder. I joke he's got a chip on his shoulder the size of the Rock of Gibraltar, but maybe that's underestimating. Maybe it's the size of Jupiter, and that is something that really does resonate with the Russian people. That the terms of the conclusion for the Cold War were unfair and illegitimate, and particularly the terms for the post Cold War order were illegitimate because Russia was weak and Russia had inadequate voice, and that the West and particularly the United States, took advantage of Russia during a period of weakness. Now, one can understand why one would have that view, and we could debate the advisability of the expansion of NATO, forever, and it probably will be debated forever. But when the response is to essentially, to take actions, and this is what happened essentially with the military occupation in Crimea, which drastically undermine core agreements about the post-Cold War order. The one that I point out repeatedly is the Budapest Memorandum, in which the Belarus, Kazakhstan, Ukraine gave up their nuclear weapons that were on their territory as part of the Soviet deployment of nuclear weapons. They gave up those weapons in return for the signatures, the promise of the Russians, the Americans, and the Brits to defend, protect the territorial integrity of those states. And here we are 20 years later, and that agreement is exposed as a complete sham. It's just amazing to me how easily, virtually without any debate about it, that we sold out on that agreement. And when you start selling out on kind of core agreements and that really attack the integrity of your word and the integrity of your credibility, that's a very, very, very dangerous, slippery slope. And my main critique of the Obama administration has been. It's not so, to get surprised by what Mr. Putin pulled off in Crimea. Okay. I mean, that was a heck of a maneuver he pulled off. Hats off. Okay. We can't legitimately recognize it, but But, but from a tactical standpoint, from an operational standpoint, to essentially be able to take over a territory of 2.5 million people in a bloodless manner is pretty impressive. But when we're with other measures, with that and other measures where we're really talking about depriving Ukraine of its sovereignty and its independence, that I think is just you can't go there. So I completely agree with Strobe in that we cannot have an agreement in which that we make the promise that Ukraine cannot, will not join NATO. It completely undermines all of the principles that that we have stood for decades, generations. This is a decision ultimately for the Ukrainians to take themselves if they would like to join NATO, and then for NATO itself to make the decision if it should come up that they would want to embrace Ukraine. And of course, it would be unlikely to happen, or more than unlikely to happen, when there's actually a territorial dispute in a country. No country with a territorial dispute has been admitted to NATO. But it's this, one thing that really bothered me, for example, Ian, the past day, that Secretary Kerry was negotiating, having discussions with Russian Minister Lavrov, essentially about the future of Ukraine. And to me, that's a violation of Ukraine's sovereignty. The excuse is that, well, the Russian Federation doesn't recognize the government in Kyiv as legitimate, so the Americans can stand in. But why should we kind of buy into the Russian position on that? It's a slippery slope. No matter how you carve it, to me that is sort of a deprivation of Ukrainian sovereignty. And when we start going down that road, it's hard to see where it ends.
Well, but it seems to me, though, just obviously, there's no point in trying to go back on history, but the idea that we spent trillions on winning, in quotes, the Cold War, and then we basically didn't pony up any real aid to Russia when it really needed it, and we were sort of dancing in the end zone over our victory in the Cold War. And now we've got a situation where, you could argue that it's not that dissimilar to what happened with the Versailles Treaty that humiliated the Germans. Arguably, Yeltsin's Russia was Weimar Germany, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, the analogy really holds in many respects. It was to the extent that the United States and the West, had a window of opportunity to provide aid that could have made a real difference in the direction of Russia's trajectory. I think it was a short-lived window, and it was in the fall of 1991 into the spring of 1992. And we did not deliver. We did not deliver. And I think that was a huge mistake. Now, you can't run the counterfactual to see what would happen if we had, but by that time, we'd essentially kind of, the reformers in Russia had already lost. There was the natural backlash against the reformers because not so much of the reforms themselves, but, whoever was taking over Russia back in the beginning of 1992 was basically taking over a country whose, decisions about allocation of economic resources had been made on a non-market basis for, 70 years. And, that legacy was going to be very, very, very hard to address. And, in fact, the Russians are still trying to address it, factories in sort of single factory towns and places that just don't make sense in a market economy, but they made sense in the Soviet sort of military industrial complex economy. So yeah, we made a big mistake. We were short-sighted at that time. you know, and that we really are seeing, I think, the kind of the Weimar Russia scenario that we feared back in the 1990s kind of coming to pass. I mean, this regime in Moscow, it does resemble a fascist regime in many respects. And Mr. Putin is kind of giving it the Rush. It's the typical Russian flavor that there are enemies around us. We need to batten things down at home. We need to, and we don't have the luxury of having, a democratic system. So we're falling back on the old Russian model of highly centralized political power, combined increasingly with, well, we're seeing more allocations to the military, but nothing along the scale of what was the Soviet Union, but much more aggressive and assertive behavior, you know, towards its neighbors. And it's not an easy policy problem to solve by any stretch of the imagination. But my kind of critique for the Obama administration for the past month is that there needs to be more resoluteness, more firmness. There needs to be more integrity to our word. You know, when we said back on February 28th, the president said that there would be, you know, significant costs incurred on the Russians if they, did a military incursion, if they annexed territory. Well, you know, the fact is we haven't. We just haven't. And the danger of that is that it creates, I think, in Mr. Putin's mind, an excessively permissive environment, which can lead him to miscalculate and make a more dramatic step that would likely, have very negative impact on the long term for him. Maybe not, but probably. I.e., let's say some kind of ground war in Ukraine. But there would not only be a tragedy for Russians and Ukrainians, but it would be just a huge setback for European security, and I think a huge setback for U.S. national interests and U.S. credibility. And I'm afraid it would be a terrible, terrible blow to Mr. Obama's legacy, and that he would be viewed as the guy that sort of lost a lot of what was won in the Cold War. And that's why I think he really, really, really needs to focus, I think, on the magnitude of what's at stake here. And we're not, you know, we're kind of not accustomed to doing that. And it's not where he wants to put his energy. We know that. You know, he wants to do nation building at home. But, you get to deal with the hand that you get. And this is a crisis of very, very serious proportions. And so for some ways, you know, I personally feel it's, I started studying the Soviet Union back in college 37 years ago, and I just feel that this is a more dangerous moment than any time since then. And so we really need to think more seriously about measures to deter Mr. Putin from doing something that is going to have really, really potentially catastrophic consequences for a lot more than just the Ukrainians and the Russians.
Well, just in closing, Andrew Cutchin, so if we are going into this era, whether it, you know, it's going to be a sort of the Cold War light, there's still that mechanism at play that is like the Cold War of reciprocity, of tit for tat. And
right.
To me, that is, we've seen that movie before, and it's a bad one. Is there
right.
anything more imaginative? I'm not suggesting we should roll over and show our soft underbelly, but I'm suggesting something along those lines, that maybe we should try something different. Is there a way to win this guy over and to remove or assuage his paranoia? I mean, I don't know whether you heard that story from the former Secretary of the Treasury, who at the time he was dealing with the TARP crisis, the Chinese were worried that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were going to go under, and they had trillions invested, He was trying to reassure them and get money out of the Congress, and then the Chinese told him that Putin had got in touch with them and had said, why don't we dump all of our American holdings, which would have, of course, really created the 2008 crash, would have turned into the Depression. So if that's true, this guy is not our friend. But on the other right. hand, you don't want to make an enemy out of this guy. So is there anything we can do?
You know, I think it's going to be very, very, very hard to make him turn back. I mean, this is, okay, I mean, this is a guy that's been in power for 14 years. He, and, you know, he feels like he is the master of his universe. It's a guy that's been underestimated all his life, I think since being a little kid. But he's found ways to, you know, to overcome that. And, you know, I think for him, that collapse of the Soviet Union was a trauma. And so I wrote in the CNN piece a few days ago that Russia is experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder. And I saw that, you know, Mr. Obama said something to the effect that, well, you know, come on, that was like 20 plus years ago. Well, but the problem with trauma and traumatic stress disorder is that, you know, it can last a very, very long time. And especially if it's untreated, it simply gets worse. And, you know, I think Mr. Putin, I think, is over the time he's been in power, he's accumulated in the way he calculates just too many data points that point to one, that you know, we, particularly the United States, are the enemy, that we do seek to undermine him. We would love to see him thrown out of power. That's why he's so sensitive to regime change that takes place either at the hand of U.S. military power or at, social, economic, political forces mobilized on the ground. And, you know, this is here's kind of the core problem of Ukraine, in that the February 21st agreement, which, you know, we signed, the Europeans signed, the Russians were present but did not sign, which called for Mr. Yanukovych to stay in power for another 10 months. And the people on Maidan in the square, they revolted, didn't accept that. Which I expected to happen, not because I wanted it to happen, but just because of the situation. And then Putin's read on that is that that's a West-supported coup, you know? But it's not a West-supported coup. The Europeans didn't want that to happen. The Obama administration didn't want to happen. It was something that was kind of uncontrollable. But he will always read that it is external forces that are kind of at the hand, that are the most powerful influence there. And, you know, whether he believes that because he actually believes it or whether it's just sort of instrumental and useful for him to believe it that way because it justifies stepping very, very hard on any sort of socially mobilized resistance or opposition in Russia, I can't answer that. But that's the way he behaves. So I think for me, the most important thing we can do in the near term is to prevent the situation getting worse. And I think for that, we really do need to put more attention to both on the economic side and on the military side, you know, increasing the capacity of the Ukrainian government to deter Russia. And I'm not talking about anything like troops on the ground or an Article 5 commitment to Ukraine, but just to change the calculation for what the cost would be, let's say, if a military invasion were to take place. And then simultaneously and we've been doing better on this score, particularly the IMF package coming through, you know, to get the funds to the Ukrainian government to ensure that, one, they don't go bankrupt before the elections on May 21st, but that they have a real, program and the capacity to implement that program in place over the next couple of years where they can put themselves in a position where they actually are more sovereign and independent. Because the biggest problem for Ukraine is the tremendous disappointment of the three governments after the Orange Revolution. I mean, they were virtually useless from the standpoint of putting Ukraine in a stronger economic position to be able to act more independently. As you noted, these are basically, you know, various forms of kleptocracies not too dissimilar from that which Vladimir Putin runs in Moscow. So, you know, a lot of it's also on the Ukrainians themselves, and hopefully, kind of like Samuel Johnson said about the imminence of a beheading will focus the mind, that, you know, they'll realize that, you know, their sovereignty really is on the line here. They really are in danger, and they've got to get it right this time. Otherwise, it's going to be a very, very bad outcome in which their sovereignty is going to perhaps go away for a very, very, very long time.
Well, Andrew Cutchins, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure, Ian.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Andrew Cutchins, who's a senior fellow and director of the Center for Strategic and International Relations, Russia and Eurasia Program, as well as the former director of the Russian and Eurasian Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. His recent publications include Perspective, What's to Follow the Demise of the U.S.-Russian Reset, The End of the Reset, Russian Foreign Policy, Continuity and Change, and he has an article at CNN, Does Obama Really Understand Putin? We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the new report from the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change with Elizabeth Colbert.